probably to the hairdresser in the morning or something, you know. And and I was crossing the cross between the tube station, the other side of the road, and I was Hogarth Road. I was on Hogarth Road, which is like 2 minutes from the train station.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly on the crossing, it had been just raining luckily. I remember like it was yesterday. Suddenly I see a Jaguar going like without stopping and trying to stop in front of me and with the brakes, you know, like because it was going too fast, and it nearly killed me.
Oh no! Oh God!
And it was Brian Lane, man. So he did the finger to me, and I kind of answered him with the two fingers up, you know. And then 5 minutes later, we were meeting at my flat.
Did he realize it was you and vice versa when you actually met each other?
And we had a big laugh about it, you know. So while he was taking me to Walsman's store, you know, in the barn that had all the equipment. And then when I arrived there, of course, we arrived there around 3 o'clock. Everybody there, the roadies were there. There was a couple of trailers, and there was this huge barn where all the equipment was ready and humming, ready to play, excited, you know, the equipment. And then Eddie Offord had designed a very special kind of portable studio, state of the art, with his 24 track machine and a huge, very very lightweight but very special desk that he was going to use also for the live recording, and he was using for the live rehearsals. And I think that's actually that afternoon that he recorded what I had invented. On the spot, when after having played me a few bars of Sound Chaser, the song, John Anderson and Steven and Chris as well mentioned, and after I had tuned the keyboards, banged it without a tune, because they had been there for the weekend and whatever, they said, how would you maybe... You know, if you were with us, of course I didn't have the gig then, but if you were with us, what would you come up with for an introduction to that song, to Sound Chaser? And I said, oh, no problem, like that. I came up with that. That was really completely improvised and then crystallized instant composition.
Hey, I was going to say, Patrick, you beat me to it. It sounds like your mythology, even then, this instant composition, because speaking to you now, that doesn't surprise me that you came up with that instantly. But to be honest, I would also believe you if you told me, I went away down for, you know, a week, and I thought about it, and I played it over and over and over again, and either story would have worked, to be honest. But to hear you, that's wonderful to hear you say
is that I played it a couple of times, maybe 2-3 times, and at the same time, as I was crystallizing that as an instant composition, did this very introduction, I was explaining also to Chris and Alan the rhythmical counterpart, you know, and then to the very precise thing. So as I was explaining it, and I was playing it over and over, by that time I would have played it maybe 5 or 6 or 7 times. I know Eddie Offord had all the instruments and the keyboards and, of course, the bass and the drums and everything mic'd up and ready to go. And I know that this introduction, after we agreed, you know, Chris and Alan and even John with his little flute,
that's right, yeah.
Over the keyboard, I know all this was recorded at that very day, that time, that when... audition.
Wow. So it came to place quite quickly then, really. It all sort of...
Very, very quickly. And then I think that's... I think I even got the gig, you know, as we would say in English. I think that's when I would have gotten the gig. Because anyway, the next day, Brian Lane called me on the Thursday night, and he said, Patrick, you got the gig. And I was
Did you think at the time there, Patrick, that you'd got this? Did you think to yourself after that first meeting that, were you confident with yourself that you'd probably got it?
No, it was a very, very, very... very difficult decision for me because I was still with refugee.
Of course, yes.
I knew Keith had started disbanded refugee to go with the LP, and although it was 4 years after, my first meeting in 1969 in Basel with Lee Jackson and Brian Davison during an ELP, during a nice concert in which I didn't even see because I missed the plane from London.
Uh-huh.
And I had met them and we had exchanged phone numbers, and it took Lee Jackson 4 years to call me, to ask me to do the band, you know, which was well, the name Refugee we found at a later stage. You know, we found almost at the time we were finished recording the album. In the beginning of 74. So, to cut the story short, you know, I was extremely uncomfortable with having to make the decision to join. Yes, and as I would say, and I'm going to only say it once, at that point, at that very moment, even during that rehearsal in the barn and during even the little recording of, I say little recording because it was only a few minutes long, you know, the mm-hmm. beginning of Sound Chaser. And maybe also, although they played for me N.U. and I, and we tried some of N.U. and I, and we tried some da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and I did that, although there was no mellotron, because Vangelis didn't have a mellotron.
Okay.
I played those lines eventually either on an electric piano or on a Hammond, which was there sitting. So, you know, but they had known that I would... They felt I would be able to play all the licks and all the parts, you know. But personally speaking, I didn't, and I'm going to say, I have to say this only once.
Please do, Patrick, please do.
At that point, I didn't want the gig, yes, because it was creating so much turmoil in my mind and in my heart. I mean, you know, I was almost sick physically and so on. When Brian Lane called me that Thursday, told me I got the gig, I felt like my speakers in my little basement flat were starting to jump, and it was like you would see in a movie, you know, where you open the door and some kind of supernatural on the evil side, wind kind of, you know, and that's how I felt. And you know, of course, there was nothing evil about it or nothing. But you know, you would see in a movie, you know, like the doors open and all of the curtains are flying out and everything, and it starts storming and raining. That's exactly how I felt inside of my mind at that moment when he told me I got the gig. And I said, "But what are we going to do? I'm still a refugee. We still have some concerts to do, and we're just on the verge to record a new album." He said, "May." He said, "Patrick, don't worry, I've all arranged it, and we were going to take out of your mates in the band, and, you know, blah, 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 and I've arranged it with record company, and I was on Charisma Records at the time."
Uh-huh, yes, that's right.
And he said, "Everything's arranged, and you can still finish your concert season with Refugee, and anyway, I'll come and pick you up tomorrow, and we'll sort out everything." That was the Friday, and and the Friday afternoon, after I saw Brian, and then he brought me to the office, and this explained everything with the guys in the band already, because they were in a, I don't know why, that they were in an extremely hurried situation to complete what was going to be Relayer, and mm-hmm. they wanted to go back on tour to still profit of that momentum they had with previously with the recording of Topographic Oceans and Close to the Edge and Fragile and so on, Yes album, and so they wanted to finish the year without doing anything. So
okay.
And so when I came back on that Friday afternoon, I had already called Brian and Lee that I wanted to see them at my apartment to discuss something with them. And that's at that moment that I did discuss with Lee and Brian exactly what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Brian had told me, "We're going to make you an offer you can't refuse, you know." which was at the time, of course, becoming a fully-fledged member of the band. And, you know, and so I asked Lee and Brian. I was very, very embarrassed, I've got to say. And because we loved each other, we were very good friends. You know, Brian Davidson was my soulmate in the band. You know, and, you know, to talk about soulmatehood, you know, and I can tell you that Brian and I, we were still talking together about 4 weeks before he passed away last year.
Wow!
In the beginning of 2008.
Yes.
And,
yes.
But he had never really told me exactly what he had. You know, that brain cancer that he had. You know, I talked to his wife, Terry, and, you know, that's how I knew, and I was still on speaking terms with him, and Lee as well. I mean, I talked to Lee several weeks before. I've talked to Lee many, many times, but anyway, to come back to that Friday afternoon, that's actually, I think that was the day, the very day that Nixon resigned.
Wow.
And that's the day I was kind of officially accepted or you know, asked to join Yes, and at the same time it was the day that I broke the news to Lee and Brian, who were absolutely wonderful and comprehensive and I mean understanding conference.
They understood your situation by the sounds
absolutely.
Of things, Patrick.
The first thing I asked them, I said, what would you do in the same situation? If you were presented with the same situation, what would you do? And they said, well, we'd do what you should do. And I said, what is that? They said, you join Yes. You know, cause also we were experiencing a few difficulties. For some reason, we didn't have really a proper management as strong as we wanted. We had a few people who tried to did some things, but we didn't have an official proper manager for Refugee. And also, with the record company, I think we had difficulties finding a producer, although I think John Burns would have been fantastic for the next album of Refugee. John Burns, you know, the producer of Genesis.
That's right,
who had produced for us, co-produced for us the Refugee. And, you know, we understood that that the record company and Strat, you know, Tony Strat, since at the time the creator, the founder of Charisma Records, with the accountant of the company, wanted to slash our potential advances to something which was not operationable, you know, to record a full album like we did the first one. And that would have been we would have been engaging in a very difficult situation, although I think we were just about starting to break in the United States with Refugee.
Mm-hmm.
And I even understand that at that point, although I hadn't been told that, I think Brian Davidson and Lee Jackson had already been spending a few days in New York doing some interviews about the coming of Refugee in the States, but I was not made aware of this.
So you didn't know about this at the time. I mean,
no, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And so, anyway, so it's, you know, I mean, it's history now, but you know.
But you joined, yes, though, Patrick. But you still played. You still honoured your. You said earlier you had a few concerts that you still had to play with Refugee.
Yeah. We still had a few gigs to complete, and we did. And we had a fantastic time, and I think. The last gig we played, I don't know if it was at the Roundhouse or it was maybe down. It was a. I remember the gig. Yeah, I remember where it was. I can't tell you exactly. I don't exactly remember. Maybe
was it in London? In London, was it, Patrick?
It was in London. I think it was in South London, in a university,
uh-huh.
in a college. You know, it was not. It's London College, but we had played also the Roundhouse gig was played at that moment, not that Sunday, but the Sunday after that, I think. And we had another one. You know, we had two or three gigs. Anyway, we completed them very well. It was good. And then, so you see, I was still with Refugee. I was learning with John and Steve, they were kind of kind enough to invite me to their homes and show and just play me a few bars of this, few bars of that, explain the song and do this and you know, go over that and go over that and every day. And I was also recording, starting to record for Relaya,
mm-hmm.
and changing location, because that eventually took place in
was it Chris Squire's home?
Yeah,
yeah?
Exactly. Yeah, where was that? In Walton Street?
Virginia, in Surrey, in Virginia Water, in Surrey.
In Surrey, yeah.
In Surrey, Chris Squire, didn't he have, he'd built a studio in his home.
Wow, man, you saw.
I read a lot. I spend too much time indoors, Patrick, reading. I should...
This is unbelievable. Anyway, so I was very busy, and of course I was commuting from my flat from Earl's Court every day to Chris's house or to John's house or to Steve's house, or and I was starting to get my I had my roadie as well,
mm-hmm.
Of course Ray Palmer, who was a fantastic roadie, who had supported me all throughout the time with Refugee and with Yes, of course. He started with me with Refugee, and I remember Ray Palmer. You know, sometimes we don't talk enough about the roadies, because the roadies are so loyal and so important to the career of a musician. Especially, you know, in England, I've got to say that there is a confederation. It's like a contrary of roadies and
mm-hmm.
musicians. And all these groups, you know, the roadies are very, very important. I think a lot of careers of musicians wouldn't have happened if they hadn't had their roadies. It's like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. You know? Oh, it's like the you know, during the Middle Ages, you had these crusaders from England going to the Middle East and so on, and they always had the people who used to take care of their horses, of their
armors, of course, yeah.
of their armors and of their arms and of their weapons and of their chicks or whatever.
The unsung heroes of the story, really.
You know, and it was very fun. So Ray Palmer, I've got to say that he was a wonderful guy, very, very different. Actually, he himself looked like Don Quixote himself. He was a huge guy. He was almost like 6.5 foot high, and he had really long hair, and he was very strong, and he absolutely wanted to be my road manager. The very day I came to England to start rehearsing, before we even had found the name of Refugee,
mm-hmm.
Ray Palmer was actually camping. He had taken residence outside, I think, Lee Jackson's house.
Okay.
To meet me, and to convince me for at least for a week to 10 days or a few days that he wanted to be my roadie, man. And he was my roadie. Of course, I engaged him, and he took care of my the physical aspect, the hardware part, you know, all the instruments and the keyboards and this and so on, all through throughout the middle of 78, you know, when I was finishing my own third Patrick Murat solo album in Geneva, Switzerland, but I had already been signified by the Moody Blues that they would like to meet me and so on. They wanted to meet me. No, I'm jumping quickly, because I'm talking about Ray Palmer, who was a great, great roadie,
mm-hmm.
and who associated with Jean, who was my kind of Jean Vistorin, my sound engineer, roadie as well. And Ray and Jean were my personal crew, you know, for the beginning of Yes. And Ray Palmer was my roadie for all throughout the life of Refugee, you know.
Wow, fantastic! So he must have convinced you, though, Patrick. He must have done a good job. I mean, his perseverance, I think, paid off, really.
Yes, I mean, I know that. Of course, there must have been some kind of hardships and you know, different feelings. But the mutual feeling, as I remember it, because I made sure that. That Lee and Brian would be taken care of you know, royally, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When I joined, yes, and I made sure of that, and I know that it was a very, very honorable discharge, in a way, you know.
And, yes,
And very honorable split. And that's all I can say about
it. Well, no, that's a wonderful story, actually, considering some of the stories you hear, which are far less honourable and far less acrimonious. You know, that is a very warm story that you've kindly shared with me there, Patrick. Wonderful stuff. But it must have been amazing, though, really, to go out on the during that peak time in Yes's career to some of the concerts that you play with the guys in Philadelphia, and I mean literally tens of thousands of people. I mean, you mentioned the Queen's Park Rangers football stadium, but we're seriously, that was a huge, and of course a lot of the songs that were recorded during that time have materialized on the Yes Shows album. Which you played on. I think it was Ritual that you played on there.
Oh, that was wonderful. Oh, yeah, man, that was fantastic. I really loved that part of Topographic Ocean, Side 4 especially. But we played, I think, if we didn't play them all at one given point, we never used to play the four sides in one row, but we rehearsed them. I remember having side one, side two, side three, side four. You know, of course, there were some more obscure sides than others, but I know the favorite was definitely side four, which was a
Ritual. Band. Yeah, absolutely.
And on stage, and with all that percussion and sounds in the middle, and you know, of course, having played also Gates of Delirium earlier in the show, and then side four towards the end, it was a very, very large show, you know, which lasted several hours. I mean, I think at some point, the show in the United States lasted up to 4 hours.
My goodness, that is something else. I mean,
we eventually slashed it a bit because, you know, I think for a few days or for a few weeks, we even tried to play some solo material of our solo album, because it was, especially in 76, you know.
That's anyway. Right, I was going to, just quickly ask you about that, if you don't mind just quickly talking about that, because of course you guys went off and did, at this time, 76, you all went off and did a solo album, and I was speaking to some of the fans. I mean, my friend Jeff, wonderful, yes, wonderful person, and a huge Yes fan in the States, he said that he's a little bit older than me, he won't mind me saying so, and he thought, buying the Relayer album and then you subsequently going off to do your solo material, that perhaps it could have been the end of Yes, particularly with the song To Be Over, wonderful tune, especially with you personally, with the Mellotron and so on, but it was almost as if a lot of the fans were thinking that perhaps it was the end of the band, that you were, you know, that you'd gone off to do your solo careers. I mean, obviously that didn't happen, and I presume that wasn't the intention of that last track, the To Be Over, on the Relayer album.
Right, I agree totally, and I could see that. You see, at the time, when I was not politically and artistically attuned to all these little details and so on, I was just doing what I had to do, which was going, the show must go on, do this, do that, and
mm-hmm,
I was
mm-hmm,
doing it
mm-hmm.
and doing my very best. But I understand what you're saying about To Be Over, which was a wonderful tune as well, but it was very kind of a bit of a down, beautiful tune. I remember having written my little solo after the reprise, you know, I written all this down on paper during the time that they were recording that at Chris's studio,
mm-hmm.
and I even wrote that piece in two or three different keys at the time, all on paper, because there was so very little space for me in the notes to play something, and I wanted to have something like contrapuntal, you know. I remember that part of To Be Over, but the song itself, the vocals, the lyrics, very subtle kind of music after such a big piece like this.
Absolutely, there was this quiet sort of, it wasn't melancholic really, but perhaps, I suppose, in hindsight, with the events, like say you guys taking the opportunity to record solo albums, that perhaps some fans may have come to that conclusion that, you know, it was perhaps the break, not the breakup of the band, but you'd perhaps decided to, you know, call it a day temporarily. But obviously, like you say, and I heard that story as well, that when you did go on the road again after recording, having recorded your solo, various solo albums, which you yourself personally played on others, Chris Squire recently remastered and re-released his Fish Out of Water CD, and there's an interview on that CD where he talks about you and obviously the one, your keyboard playing, which you brought to that album. The Silently Falling is one track. You play a wonderful solo towards the end. It sounds like a jam, really. and he mentions you. I can't remember exactly. I think it was a bass synthesizer which you played on one of the songs. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. But there's like an interview on Chris's remastered CD, which he's done, and he's talking about you, Patrick, and this innovation that you brought to some of the tracks that you played on. And you played on Steve Howe's solo album and vice versa, and...
That's right, I arranged... I mean, Steve gave me a piece that he wanted to call Beginnings, you know, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
And you arranged the orchestration, I think, on that track, didn't you?
And he had explained to me what he wanted to do, and he said, well, at the end of the day, you know, just to, you know, with a... take a little orchestra, you know, chamber orchestra, and you play harpsichord, and you know, you could arrange it a la Vivaldi or something. I took that piece, and two or three weeks later, I came back to him with the whole arranged piece, the 6 minute 40, I think, of it, and of course that didn't sound anything like Vivaldi, but it sounded what it sounds like now, and I was actually very. Very happy to have been able to do that for him, and he was knocked out. He said, wow, man, in the studio, they didn't expect that at all, you know. So what happened is that we recorded the piece with the orchestra, I come back and played at the same time on the article, and we hired some 16 musicians from the London Symphony Orchestra, you know, in North London, in another studio, very good little studio, and then, we did the contractual 3 hours or 2 hours and a half it takes to do a complete session with a couple of other things with the musicians. And I think Steve had either given us just a guide track and so on, but he eventually re-recorded his guitar on top of the orchestra exactly the way he wanted in different sessions. And that turned out actually very well. And it was also the start of his what was going to become... in a way, a little bit of his trademark for his subsequent solo albums. I understand.
Yes, of course, yeah.
With of course the wonderful Price, what's his name, Andrew
Price Jackman.
Andrew Jackman. And yes. You know whose brother was our recording engineer when I joined the Moody's in 1978.
I didn't know that connection. That's interesting.
He was the sound engineer with Pip Williams in 1980. Pip Williams was the producer, and Jackman, Doc Andrew's brother, was the engineer. Fantastic engineer, and he was also the engineer who recorded the Presence, subsequently with the Moody's in 1982. But in 1980, during some weekends, we had three, and I was trying things on my keyboards. I used to come to the studio, the Decca studio we used to have in North London.
Mm-hmm.
He was with me, and he was also the engineer on How Basic Can You Get, which is actually the only song which was not instantly composed for Future Memories 2, and which took me several weekends actually to record in London, and you know that song, How Basic.
Yes, yeah, of course.
So that's the only song that's the exception which confirms the rule here, and you know, Jackman was a really, really fantastic guy to work with. A very enlightened person, engineer. He had a wonderful girlfriend. He was the best guy. Also for the Moody Blues, I've got to say that with Pip Williams and Jackman, the engineer, in 1980 for Long Distance Voyager.
Yes, of course, that was a hugely successful album.
The best guys for the job, and we really, really had a very, very strong bond. and a very strong friendship when we did this album, these albums, you know, and I was very, very happy with their work and their interaction and their suggestions and, you know, the whole thing, you know, fantastic, you know.
That's a very, very interesting... Thank you again, Patrick, for sharing that. That's something I didn't know. It was Andrew Price, Jackman's brother, who'd worked with. I didn't know that. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful story. Wow. So, anyway, listen, just going back to the Change of Space, the new release, it was something I really, really want to ask you. Wonderful album, as we discussed very early on in this interview, and you've been very generous with your time. I really do personally appreciate it. Are there any thoughts about doing live performances? I know over the last few years, it seems to me you've primarily concentrated on solo piano performances. The Patrick Myers in Princeton, that's a wonderful CD, and the subsequent DVD that goes with that as well, and the ESP album, I think, was the last album that you released prior to Change of Space. I mean, now that you've got this, you know, like I say, the collection of musicians that you've worked with, you're obviously very connected musically with a lot of people, very fortunate in that respect, perhaps. What are your thoughts? I mean, are you planning to do any live performances? Do you have any other recordings that you're either working on or contemplating working on?
Absolutely. I've got several projects in the pipeline, but of course, I want to go full swing, at least if not for the rest of this year, because, you know, even for this summer, to bring a band like the Change of Space band, unless there were a lot of dough available, you know. For the pre-production and for the rehearsals and the hiring of the guys and you know, to have the space and time to rehearse really well, to go, it's a bit late. But my aim is to not only carry on doing, of course, my own solo concerts with keyboards and instrument and piano and what I mean. I did a couple of solo concerts last year in Seattle, but to have a whole band like the guys and to have to play with Ronnie Siago and John Wackerman and Ronnie Brunel and Don Ailey and Alex Ridgewood would be unbelievable. I mean, I'd love to do that, and some backup singers and maybe another bunch of keyboard players as well, because as you know, I always do quite a few overdubs when I record, you know.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I would love to be able to do that. Maybe I'll start with a trio or I also have, of course, the intention and to play some, if not maybe some another outfit of piano and drums, like I used to do with Bill, but I've got a very, very good friend of mine. He's like my little brother. His name is Jacob Arnon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Armenia?
Okay, yes, yeah.
I have the tune of Keshasa on his new album that I recorded with him in Los Angeles some time ago, and he actually added a bass player to the fold, so it's like a trio, but his album and that guy is a fantastic drummer. He's got a new album coming out. He has already some pieces on video, and he's a multi-instrumentalist himself. He plays santur and he plays this and that, and he's a real drum genius, so I might be doing some shows with him sporadically on a very, I would call it a rapid deployment unit, kind of a duet or trio, because he really wants to, he loves playing with me, and of course I love playing with him, yeah, he's like absolutely unbelievable, but I'm not ruling out the possibility to play also with the guys who have played on Change of Space, like I used to play with Ronnie Siago quite a lot around in the clubs, like the Baked Potato and so on. Very good drummer. Very, very good drummer. And who recorded with me that, you know, that a piece called One Day in June. A few years ago, I invited him to play at the University of Florida. So I was booked to play a show for the Full Sail School of recording arts.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 3,000 students there. And so I invited Ronnie to come and play the show with me, which he did. And he was he had this new remold ones that was made especially were made especially for him. And so the day after, or a couple of days after the show at the university, which was very, very successful, I took him to my studio, the Audio Playground studio, which doesn't exist anymore, which had at the time 700 or 800 keyboards, man. You know,
amazing.
I had my own space in Studio 3 at the end of the building, and that's where I recorded some of the pieces which are actually on A Change of Space, like Sonic Prince I recorded there, and the one day in June I recorded that I had composed more or less that tune in my head. I did it as an instant composition. We did 3 takes of it, and I think it's the 3rd take with just me on keyboards and him on drums that one day in June. And I took those recordings, that very recording of, it's about, what, 7 minutes?
Seven minutes.
I took that, and I worked then on it. I overdubbed all the rest of the instruments for another 7 weeks. On my own, I did the bass, synthesizer, and all the instrumentation. And that took me, you know, quite a while to come up with all this stuff. But it sounds like, you know, Ronnie did a fantastic job. It's a great tune to play because it's very melodic. You know, it's a very, very melodic kind of thing. Very, it's almost easy listening, but it's almost it's rock, but it's almost also a kind of fusion, jazz fusion.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and it's still challenging to play, and it can be played with other instrumentalists, which I would, bring to the fold, or it can be played as a duet with just electronic keyboard and drums, you know. So it give us a lot of flexibility for the future, and I have then a lot of opportunities to play with all these guys that I love. I mean, you know, the Barney Brunel, man, he's the French bass player that I actually introduced to Chick Corea in 78, and Chick
Corea, that's another story. Fantastic.
In London at Ronnie Scott's, and Ronnie was playing at Ronnie Scott's with a Brazilian lady pianist, very good, and with a drummer, and that drummer is also French, and they were playing at Ronnie Scott's, but I had known them in the summer when I was finishing. Before going to rehearse with the Moody's, and by the time I was finishing my 3rd album, Patrick Runs, those guys came to jam with me in the studio. And if you can hear something, if you have the new release of my Story of My CD by Voice Print,
mm-hmm,
there's a bonus track where I play just at the end, apart from the kids singing, you know, there's a bonus.
Of course, of
me also trying to play that tune or playing something, an improvisation with a drummer, and that drummer is the guy who was the drummer of Barney Brunel and that when they were Ronnie Scott. And I've just discovered that tape, and I thought it sounded so fresh and so spontaneous. I thought I'll put it as a bonus then, you know. So anyway, coming back now to the 78 Ronnie Scott, that was probably in, must have been in September of 78, because I tell you what, very early September of 78, Barney Brunel and that accompanying the lady, Ronnie Scott, Chick Corea was playing at the Rainbow in London. You remember?
Mm-hmm. I don't, but I know all about it, Patrick. The Rainbow Club is sadly now closed, but yeah, it's a historic venue for number of concerts.
So I knew Chick, of course, before from the I'd met him, you know, and I came backstage after the concert. It was his last concert of 2 or 3 an appearance at the Rainbow, and all the journalists, everybody, the fans were waiting for him. So I whisked him away. I took a cab, and going back.